This is Jeff Bastian, and you're listening to Ignited with Meaning, where we'll be exploring the terrain of a meaningful life, creating a roadmap for that, and generating more happiness along the way. In this first episode, I'm interviewing Adria Goodness, who is a psychiatric nurse practitioner who has found a really unique niche in working primarily with women and the mental health issues they face before, during, and after pregnancy and childbirth. Adria started out her professional career as a nurse midwife, working with mothers and their families through pregnancy and delivery, but as a result of that experience, as well as her personal experience going through pregnancy and having kids of her own, Adria made an expedited transition in her career. What I really love about this interview is how multifaceted it is. We really have several different storylines here to track, and I want to cue you into what those are. The first one is that we get to dive deep into the challenge of the mental illness that so many women face before and after childbirth. I don't know how many of you understand how big of an issue this is, but there are some astonishing statistics that you'll hear about the number of women who face this challenge at a time in their lives when there are so many expectations about what this experience is supposed to be about. So even if this isn't an issue for you personally, the statistics suggest that it is practically impossible for you to go through life and not have someone close to you who is impacted by this. The second storyline that I really love is all the practical tips that we get to hear about dealing with psychological challenges. And while we talk about them in the context of women and mothers at a specific time in their lives, they are readily applicable to basically anyone who is looking to optimize their mental experience of life. Whether you are someone who is currently going through a period of anxiety or depression, or if you're going along nicely but still curious about how your mental experience could be even better, Adria does a great job outlining a series of ways to shift your thinking. She introduces us to different treatment modalities, and we even explore what she calls existential therapy, which is a term to describe the role that meaning plays in the well-being of her patients. And that brings me to the third storyline that really ties this interview back to the title of this podcast, Ignited with Meaning. We get to hear Adria talk about her life thesis, which she describes as the culmination of her personal and professional experiences. And as you listen to this interview through the end, you'll really get to hear how she's been able to pull together the various elements of her life that we talk about through the show and the meaning that she gets from doing that work and how it ignited a fire within her and propels her forward. Now, we couldn't help ourselves from diving into a range of topics from the moment Adria and I connected in person. So you'll hear this interview start after I've asked Adria to describe the confusion that our brains can have around the idea of excitement versus anxiety that we were talking about just before hitting record. So let's dive in with Ignited with Meaning, Episode 1 with Adria Goodness on how meaning can help women through pregnancy and motherhood. Tell me actually more about what you were just saying. You were just saying that some of your patients.
Yeah. So in my work with people doing psychiatry as a nurse practitioner, so doing, you know, treating them with medications and then psychotherapy, of course, I encounter a lot of people who struggle with anxiety. And one of the things that we're learning is that our brains don't always correctly interpret the signals that our bodies and our minds are giving us about sensations. And so sometimes people will actually interpret excitement or anticipation as anxiety, and our bodies don't know the difference. And so what we do a lot in therapy is we look at the data coming in from our minds and our bodies, and we try and tell what's really going on, because sometimes we can take distressing sensations and actually recategorize them as something that's totally acceptable and even wanted, you know, like anticipating a trip or a plane ride, as opposed to being afraid of it, as an example.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That seems like a pretty cool trick to transform the emotion of anxiety, which people would associate as a negative emotion, into something like excitement.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So a lot of psychotherapy is taking, you know, thoughts, feelings and behaviors and reassigning value to them and then shifting them slightly to change our lived experience. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of what we do. And it can be these microscopic, subtle shifts that can lead to something that someone who I'm not sure who it was coined as being quantum change, mm-hmm. you know, having big change for people's experiences, which is when you have a really good session. You don't have quantum change all the time with people, but when it happens, it's amazing.
Right. But you can often find opportunities for small changes.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Well, let's take a step back. I want to more you to introduce yourself. I've known you for 15 years and see you go through several different career changes. And when I first met you, you were studying to be a nurse midwife, if I'm not mistaken. And you've got your master's degree in that, and you had a whole career delivering babies.
That's right. So I came to mental health via the field of nursing, and I started out as a bachelor's prepared nursing, actually via philosophy, women's studies, and political science. I thought I was originally going to go into law and make a difference that way. But the third year of my undergrad, we had a speaker in one of my women's studies classes. I believe it was Women in U.S. History. We had a speaker that was a home birth midwife in the city of Eugene, Oregon. And the way that she was changing people's lives, sort of one family, one woman at a time, and working outside of the system felt like a wonderful, very personal path and a better use of my personal aptitudes and interests. So I immediately dropped all of my courses and became a pre-nursing student at that time, and then obtained a bachelor's degree in nursing, and with an eye on going into a master's program in nurse midwifery, but I wanted to get some bedside experience. So I worked as a laborer and delivery nurse in a birth center for several years. During that time, I learned to speak Spanish. Most of the clients I was seeing were part of the migrant farm worker community in Southern Oregon. I also became a Spanish-speaking triage nurse in a clinic that catered to that community during that time. And then I went back to school to get my master's in midwifery and practiced full-scope midwifery for 10 years, which means that I did sexual reproductive health, so family planning, gynecologic well-woman care, some primary care, including some mental health. Screening, mostly screening, evaluation, minimal treatment, and lots of referral out. And then prenatal care, intrapartum or birth-related care, postpartum care, inclusive of accompanying women into the operating room and assisting the surgeon with surgical births, as well as doing normal, vaginal births.
So that is in and of itself,
yeah,
like a complete career. A person could spend a lifetime doing what
you
did.
Yes. I mean, it's endless. Every birth, every woman, every couple, family is different. There's so much there. I didn't stop doing that work because I was, bored or felt that I had mined all of that experience for meaning or challenge or happiness.
Yes. And yet you did decide to make some sort of a change.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that period of your life and what went into deciding that you were going to switch gears and move into the field of mental health?
Yes, I would say that the theme was discomfort. I was seeing women who were, essentially healthy. If you could see me right now, I'd be making air quotes around healthy. And yet there was a remarkable amount of distress in the population I was seeing in the form of worry, anxiety, sadness, and more, and outright illness, mental illness, disordered symptoms running the gamut from, panic to generalized anxiety to depression. I cared for women that have some more chronic progressive mental illnesses as a midwife, including bipolar spectrum disorders. And my distress was around their suffering, but also my lack of preparedness to assist them. And the proportion of people that I was seeing in any given day, I usually had at least one or two people on my schedule who were in deep emotional or mental health distress. And I didn't know how to evaluate them appropriately. I didn't know how to treat them. There wasn't an adequate workforce to refer people onto. And I became frustrated. I became frustrated, and I felt like while I was doing the important work of helping people hopefully grow healthy babies and being there in the ways I could be emotionally for them. It felt like in some ways I was missing the deeper point of really being with women, which is what midwife means. It means with woman. And so I had this plan. I thought, well, you know, I'm in my 30s now. I'll have a family and I'll go back to school, you know, maybe in my 40s, and I'll get a postmaster's to become a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. And then I became pregnant with twins and had a lovely pregnancy and delivered them full term, healthy babies. And immediately, within a couple weeks of having the twins, I realized that I could no longer tolerate the sleep deprivation associated with having two infants at once and then returning to work, carrying a pager, and being up all night for work as well, 3 days a week. And so that, along with my own experiences with amazing insomnia and profound anxiety in the year after my twins were born, got me more interested in the experience of other mothers. And I decided to speed up my plan by about 10 years. And at 7 months postpartum,
So you were saying that you also had a personal experience.
Definitely.
With this. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that was like for you?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, like most women who have anxiety or depression in the postpartum, the things that I was worrying about, mostly worry, I had intrusive thoughts about things happening to my babies and images. All of those things were amplifications of normal parenting worries and things that could happen. But it was like being hijacked by them. It would happen at times when I was at rest or I could rest, which was, you know, very infrequently in a 24-hour cycle with exclusively nursing two infants at once. So I had really profound insomnia. I didn't have much time to sleep, but then when I needed to sleep, I couldn't sleep. Along with that went a lot of physical symptoms of anxiety, racing heart rate, shortness of breath, you know, feeling hot and cold, not being able to be comfortable, body aches and pains, irritability, really a physically uncomfortable experience that started probably a couple months after I had my children and then really peaked around 11 months postpartum, I would say.
I can imagine that for you and probably for a number of the mothers that you're treating, that's not what their expectation of motherhood was. Mm-hmm. Like that was what it was going to be like.
Right. Not at all. Our society does a very poor job of preparing women for the reality that about up to 20%, probably more, maybe even as many as 25% of women have symptoms of anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, and depression, actually that commonly. Less common are bipolar spectrum disorders, but they're not that uncommon either. We don't do a great job. And I think that's where a lot of the distress comes. Not only do we not tell women that this can happen, we also tell them that they should be fulfilled by having children deeply. And so I think women are very surprised sometimes when they feel maybe less fulfilled than ever by being at home with children and, you know, not getting a paycheck and maybe even being passed over by for a promotion because they became pregnant or because they want a 6-month maternity leave instead of a 3-month maternity leave. And worse for women that are, you know, don't have a college education and aren't in jobs where they can even consider advancement. Lots of women do find a lot of fulfillment in childbearing. I'm not saying that that's not a reality for women, but there's a lot of shoulds out there that set people up for disappointment and feelings of failure.
Yeah, so that's huge. And you're saying that roughly 20 to 25% of women might experience this?
If we put all the disordered symptoms together, right now it looks like with just depression alone, we're talking about 15 to 20% of women, but we also have anxiety out there.
That's huge.
Yeah, it's huge. It means that it's not this, you know, abnormal experience, really. It's on the spectrum or the continuum of experiences that women have as a part of childbearing. And it should be as much a part of childbirth education, you know, classes as learning how to breathe through early contractions. I mean, it should just be dinner table conversation.
So what you're saying, I had a chance to watch a little bit of your webinar series. Yeah. And that was the first thought that came to my mind. It's like, I did all of these classes with my spouse about, you know, learning how to change diapers and how to support her in breastfeeding and all about like the day of the labor. And I kind of feel like, well, why aren't we teaching everybody about, you know, 25% of people are going to potentially, you know, encounter some sort of a, you know, mental challenge throughout pregnancy, you know, let alone the struggles that a couple might face. It just interpersonally trying to adapt to having a baby. Like that seems like it's not the focus at all to figure out that mental health part of the solution.
You're exactly right. Mm-hmm. I think we're looking at things from sort of the wrong end of the stick. Definitely. I think we need to be thinking experientially about what's happening with parents and then figuring out how to fasten the diapers will follow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want to switch gears a little bit here. You said a number of things that I think are really interesting. And I'm wondering, in the work that you do, do you consider yourself an activist?
Very much so. I feel that there's an enormous healthcare gap in terms of clinicians being available down the pipeline to care for women who are identified as having mental health symptoms and disorders, and then women aren't being identified in the first place. And so increasingly, my interest is in closing this gap by bringing together my expertise in obstetrics and midwifery and in psychiatry, mental health, behavioral health, so that we can create a knowledge base for clinicians, mainly in the primary care, obstetric and midwifery professions to draw upon so that they can increase their skills with screening, assessment, diagnosis, and treatment of women that are appropriate for them to treat within their scope of practice and become more proficient at identifying the women who should be referred out to the super subspecialists, of which there aren't many. So we need to make sure we save those people for the women who need, you know, specialty help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's I'm trying to just orient myself here. It's like you've got, you know, we've got your story, we've got the story of these women. So for your story, you know, you started out as a, you know, delivering, helping women deliver their babies, really discovered that there was this patient population that you didn't know how to evaluate and serve. That helped you kind of move into this field of mental health, and it happened all at the same time with, you know, you having twins and feeling that you couldn't be beholden to a pager. And now you're kind of moving into, okay, not only am I training folks, but I'm going to help train others to figure out how to do that.
Right. Now I'm specifically really getting interested in training clinicians. And something I want to be very clear about, while I also want to increase the clinician knowledge base to recognize illness and to do more in terms of medical treatment, I also want to decrease clinician distress as well. One of the There were two women that I had the honor of working with as a nurse midwife. One was a young woman in her 20s, newly married, working as a nanny, excited to be pregnant, planned pregnancy, first pregnancy, became acutely anxious after delivering and depressed as well, and basically stopped functioning. And I was her midwife. I was her safe person. She kept coming back to me for help, and I really didn't know what to do. I referred her out. She ended up improving over much more time than it should have taken for her to get well. That made a huge impression on me. I also had the opportunity to work with a couple women who had severe psychotic breaks due to bipolar illness as I was a midwife and didn't have the knowledge base I have now. And I know that my role in caring for them was probably better than nobody being there. But knowing what I now know, I realize that I may have slowed down their access to the appropriate level of care, that I may have had a focus on aspects of their experience that may have actually gotten in the way of them getting the highest level of care that they could have gotten, with a focus really being on mental health stabilization as opposed to, you know, infant feeding and parenting things. So I would like to help reorient my other midwifery and obstetric and primary care clinicians so that they don't feel this bewilderment and distress I felt as I was trying to set priorities in caring for these women who were deteriorating right before my eyes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, it was very powerful, very powerful, life-changing for me, really.
Yeah. I want to ask you a little bit about the role that, you know, when you are working with women specifically, I imagine you have a pretty broad toolkit. I know one of the parts of the toolkit is cognitive behavioral therapy. Can you tell me about some of the common sort of, I've heard the term thinking errors. It seems kind of condescending or something like that, but I know that that term is, it's useful. Are there particular like ways that people are, your patients are thinking that you feel like you're able to assess and help them recast their, the way that they're thinking that's most impactful?
Absolutely. I think this work is particularly fun, and I use several different modalities of therapy for sure, but cognitive behavioral therapy I think is particularly effective. We've learned that men and women think differently and they're socialized probably to think differently, but some of the common thinking errors we see in mothers are around perfectionism and flexibility. We see these things in people, you know, we see them in fathers as well. But we know that people that go into parenthood being perfectionistic and having a very set vision for how things need to be, that can be a setup for a challenging time, because here we enter an infant that is an unquantifiable, unknowable variable, basically, in, you know, a living experiment, and things often don't go as planned, you know, with an infant.
How do you help a person increase their like, so if they're kind of a perfectionist and you enter this element, how do you help them to deal with that? Or what would be the way of thinking that would be more helpful for them? Or what's the treatment?
That's a great question. So first you help them identify if that's happening for them. And so you ask them about other times in their lives when they've been presented with a challenge, or about their personal habits. And if you together identify this tendency towards perfectionism, wanting things to be a certain way most of the time, you actually talk about first the places in their lives, the times in their lives, the settings where that's adaptive, meaning that helps them accomplish what they need to accomplish. As you can imagine, Jeff, so much of the time, if you plan ahead and, you know, you keep your desk neat at work and you can find your projects, you get things done, you have a high level of performance and satisfaction in your life. So most of the time being, you know, organized to perfectionistic, it can be really helpful. And then you talk about the places where that's not so helpful. Then you do some goal setting around some superficial things that you maybe let go. You talk about what that experience was like, what were the barriers, and then you set some additional goals. And you talk about the benefits of being less perfectionistic. And what you do is you attempt to broaden your repertoire as a person of things that you can tolerate. And what happens in that process is that you install the ability to be more cognitively and emotionally flexible.
What's an example of implementing that as a new mother or new father?
That's a really good question. And what easily comes to mind when I think of a common thing that parents struggle with, and a lot of the women I see, is the changes in their environment with having an infant. All of a sudden, you know, let's say you've got, you know, two parents who, you know, have waited until they have their education, they're established in their careers, they've, you know, have a home that's just so, a baby comes home, there's all this gear with having a baby, there's not time to keep up the space. And, you know, people talk about feeling, you know, like their space has been hijacked and, you know, there's not room for them. And so over time, you can help people organize. You can make practical solutions, and there's definitely room for problem solving and therapy. But there's an element of having children in your life, and there are things that's chaotic. And if we try and continually, you know, keep our children and their things in a corner, that's not necessarily the best for children and their natural developmental process. And so you help people pick and choose and make choices around what they're going to tolerate and what they're going to focus on as maybe a family goal for making different in terms of maybe cleaning something up or getting rid of some things. And then you talk about that process and how that gives way to some new feelings of relaxing into the new normal or what is.
Mm-hmm. And so what's the, say you've got a patient and you've identified that this is a, you know, perfectionist tendency, and you're able to help them successfully overcome this tendency or find some ways to to reshape their thinking around it. For the patients you see, does this wind up being kind of a small piece of the puzzle, or is this sometimes something that can change their whole experience of parenthood?
That's a really good question. The example I'm giving you, it can be a really big thing for somebody. Like some people, you know, if their external environment is disheveled or organized, that can really impact their internal world really strongly. It's different for different people. So this piece can be really big. It can be the work. And then often this work is replicated in many different ways. For some people, this is a little piece of a larger pattern in relationships, let's say, unrealistic expectations for relating, just like we can have unrealistic expectations for our children being clean. And so we can sort of replicate this process definitely and apply it to other areas of our life where we have expectations that need to be modified around perfectionism related to other people's responses to us. So yes, this is something that you can apply to many different scenarios for people. And usually the example I gave you is a piece of a larger puzzle.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you said that there is a second example of sort of a general sort of thinking error or challenge that people have in adapting to parenthood. What was that one again?
General flexibility. So mm-hmm. I guess it's another way of talking about perfectionism. But people who are generally go with the flow do a little bit better transitioning to parenthood. And I think that speaks to having low to intermediate expectations of, you know, circumstances and events on an ongoing basis. And so you try and help people cultivate the belief that a number of outcomes in a certain scenario are good, as opposed to having, you know, one way that something can go and be a success.
Okay, great. I want to go back to something that you said earlier a little bit about, you know, there's all these expectations about parenthood and, you know, there's around fulfillment and meaning. I'm wondering, you know, about this topic of meaning. To what extent do you find that you incorporate the role of meaning in a parent's life into your therapy?
Hugely. It's a centerpiece topic, especially because inherent in the idea of meaning, is happiness. But things that are meaningful are usually inherently difficult or challenging. And when people are doing something challenging or difficult, if you don't bring meaning into the conversation, you risk running into hopelessness. So if you can bring meaning into the conversation and help people figure out where is the meaning for me personally in this experience I'm having right now, you can help people rest into the joy, happiness, learning from the given situation. So meaning is sort of, I think, the concept that the works, you know, rests on in therapy for me.
Do you have, I know that there's patient confidentiality and whatnot,
sure.
But do you have a general example of someone who you've worked with where meaning has been something that's really turned things around for them?
A type of patient population just came to mind more than a specific individual. I have the joy of working with many individuals and couples who are going through infertility. So long, protracted attempts to become parents through biomedical means. And what's involved in that is this, you know, 4 to 5 week cycle over months and years of hope and dashed hopes and a lot of relationship distress, self-esteem, body image challenges. That population is particularly challenging at times to find the meaning and the purpose of that struggle with. But I also feel like that's particularly fruitful work when you're able to find that with that particular individual or couple. An example of where I would find meaning for a particular individual, let's say, is that sometimes it's important to do what we need to do on that path to becoming parents, regardless of the outcome. Sometimes we're investing in our own needs and ourself, regardless of whether or not that ends in a child through biomedical means. Sometimes the process itself is feeding our own need to value our desires. And if we're lucky to be able to access, you know, insurance that pays for interventions, or to have money to pay for interventions, basically the process matters. The process itself is meaningful in terms of taking care of what we need, sometimes whether or not it ends in a child. So that's a narrative that I'll work with clients on that is often fruitful for people.
I can imagine that would be a hard narrative for the couple where that ends without conceiving.
Absolutely. There are no easy narratives for the couples that don't have children, although the work then becomes talking about a meaningful life that's child-free and constructing that meaning, and couples do get there. Definitely, I've had the honor of working with couples that are able to live happy and full lives where they feel that they're deeply fulfilled and contributing to society without having that initial dream. It then shifts to something else. So it can be done.
It sounds like it's pretty powerful work.
It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's juicy.
One of what you're talking about makes me think about this idea that, you know, I can imagine somebody who comes out the other end of having suffered some sort of, you know, mental health challenge throughout the parenting process or the conception process might look back on that if they come out on the other side, you know, say, wow, I wish that would have never happened. And others might say, wow, that was hard, that struggle was, you know, gave me something, or I'm the better for it. What's your take? Like, if you had a magic wand and you could wave away the challenge, the mental health challenge, would you do that? Or do you feel like that struggle is actually, you know, a really important part of the human experience? I mean, right. I feel like that's a leading question, but I'm really just interested in, you know, if you had that magic wand, would you do it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. As you were asking that, I thought you were going to ask me something else. I thought you were going to ask me for the women who say that they would wish that they didn't have that mental health challenge, and the women who go on to say it was meaningful. What's the difference? And I want to answer that question first.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
The difference really is the quality of healthcare they receive almost universally. So the women that have somebody to step in to their pain and to make meaning and to cure them, to treat them, either through behavior change, psychotherapy, complementary means, medication, and to care and to bear witness, those women often say on the other side, you know, I'm okay. It was okay. You know, not it was okay that it happened, but we made it through it, mm-hmm. you know, and somehow it made me who I am today. I think it's the women who aren't seen by anybody deeply in their mm-hmm. pain and who aren't treated, who then experience a lot of ongoing suffering and sense of loss about that time period. Mm-hmm. And would I make it go away? I think there are other ways that I think that people that are more fruitful for constructing meaning for people. I think parenting itself is challenging enough that I think that leads to a profound sense of meaning for people that choose to parent and are able to parent. And there's so much morbidity and mortality associated with mental illness, particularly in pregnant women and young families. And then, you know, broader health outcomes, physical health outcomes related to mental illness, that I think I would wave it away with a wand if I could, and then get to the business of working with people, you know, still in the capacity of helping them construct meaning. Maybe I'd catch some more babies. I don't know. But, you know, constructing meaning around maybe more everyday challenges, but not mental illness.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting question mm-hmm. because I think back on my own personal experience with different mental health challenges over time. Mm-hmm. And I often ask myself that question, mm-hmm. like, is this a gift or is it a, was it a curse? Like, mm-hmm. what would my life be like if I didn't have that? And what is it like now that I have it? And right. I'm certainly able to recast a story where I make meaning out of that experience. Mm-hmm. But I also just kind of wonder, well, would I have changed that?
Right. I think it's a really good question. I think the fact that you're even asking that reflects your own psychological mindedness and your own thinking style, which is really interesting. I also think it's important to say in this moment, you know, that despair, anxiety, worry, rumination, depression, elation, ecstasy, joy, you know, those are all part of the human experience. And they're not, these extreme feelings are not always disordered. You know, it's a disorder is defined as prolonged symptoms or distress that compromise functioning. Mm-hmm. So I think that's important for the listener. When we diagnose something as being disordered, there's very strict criteria about how long somebody has to have been suffering and whether or not it has to compromise function, and then exactly what somebody is experiencing. So, you know, a listener would need to be worried, you know, that if they were, you know, having a really bad week, you know, that they have major clinical depression and that they're now going to be doomed to a chronic, you know, recurring condition. I mean, depression is a part of the human experience. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about, so obviously cognitive behavioral therapy mm-hmm. is one of the tools that you have. Mm-hmm. Meaning is one of the tools that you have, but I imagine just for some patients, just those just don't work. Can you talk about that patient, you know, what are the treatments that are then available for those?
Yeah, I would say two other modalities that I use a lot in my toolbox are mindfulness and something called interpersonal therapy. And collectively, everything I do, the work constructing meaning, that's really existential therapy. But all of those modalities and more, basically, you're moving people towards distress tolerance, helping people, you know, tolerate these feelings they have that are within the normal human experience and beyond. And I think mindfulness is particularly helpful for that. So helping people in session join with you in the moment. So there's a number of ways that we can do that. I saw a client yesterday who, every time I see her, we start the session with doing some deep breathing, a body scan, and we sort of ground together, and my sessions with her are always wonderful and different than they are with everybody else. But so we get radically in the moment, and then we observe what's happening without judgment. And then she's got that as a skill to be able to observe her own distress in other times and really make a decision or a choice about whether or not she's going to go on the ride that distress can take her. So mindfulness is a wonderful tool. Oftentimes I've got clients who end up taking like a mindfulness-based stress reduction course. And so they're doing that in concert with psychotherapy with me, and we're analyzing their experience and reinforcing their skills and helping them continue that work in their life. One of my most often used therapy modalities, is called interpersonal therapy. It's been studied for depression, is increasingly being studied for anxiety in a number of populations, but particularly with postpartum depression. And the thing I love about interpersonal therapy is it has a psychodynamic background, meaning it's the techniques and the theory are grounded in a deep understanding of attachment relationships, early relationships. But the work you do with somebody is really grounded in the here and now, which makes it very practical for new mothers and new parents. You're basically talking about challenges with getting your needs met in current relationships. What happened this morning when you left home and had an uncomfortable or contentious interaction with your spouse? How to deal with the feelings you're having inside of you now, and how to avoid that in the future, or to have a more effective interaction tomorrow morning so that you get what you want in that relationship and you give what the person you love needs. And that is deeply rewarding work. And I find that it yields big time for people. I really love doing practical things for parents who are tired. That feels really rewarding to me, having been there myself.
Absolutely. One of the other options is a medical intervention, right?
Totally. Absolutely. So that's something, of course, that I offer as a nurse practitioner is, you know, biomedical approaches to treating psychiatric suffering. And so that covers a broad range of things. Of course, it includes medications, but we also can recommend light therapy to people, evidence-based supplements. Believe it or not, ECT or electroconvulsive therapy, which it used to be called, you know, shock therapy, is an evidence-based treatment that's available. There are other brain stimulation therapies that are evidence-based and can be helpful for difficult-to-treat or refractory cases of depression or bipolar depression that don't respond to medications. I don't do brain stimulation therapies or electroconvulsive therapy, but can refer people on for those. We have a lot of tools now in terms of medications and other treatments. The medications and the medical treatments, they're definitely not perfect. You know, there's side effects and adverse reactions. So in my practice...
Do you find that there's a stigma associated with some of the medical interventions?
Definitely. We're still in the dark ages, you know, as a society in terms of our acceptance around mental health conditions. However, it's getting better. In fact, it's getting so much better that people are telling their healthcare providers, and we don't have anywhere to send them in terms of specialists or not enough places to send them for further treatment evaluation. So there's a real shift in society happening, but there's a lot more that needs to happen in terms of stigma.
I want to go back to this idea that, you know, just doing the math here, mm-hmm. you said if 20 to 25% of, you know, or up to 20 to 25% of, you know, women are experiencing, you know, some sort of mental health condition during pregnancy, how many women just would that be at any one time?
That's a really good question. So if we were to do how many people are in this country, roughly half of them, you know, are women and take up to a quarter, you know, of those women. Well, I guess we would have to take the childbearing women, you know, of that, yeah. of that half of US population. It's absolutely stunning. The amount of impact.
There's millions.
Oh, absolutely. And this,
like probably tens of millions.
Yes. And then this
is just in this country.
And I was going to say, and make no mistake, this is a global problem. This is not a culturally specific problem in our country. This is something that's happening all over the world. So, but you know, my focus is in this country, although I feel like anything that's happening that's good in terms of improving access to care and screening, assessment, treatment rates is something that can be replicated anywhere. And hopefully we're going to learn from other countries. So, but yeah, it's stunning.
You know, when we look at things at that scale, I want to switch over to this webinar that you've put together. Mm-hmm. And we were just kind of talking about, mm-hmm. okay, well, you know, how many people could you see? Like, what's a full patient load for you personally?
So I probably see, I spend an hour with my clients and I probably see somewhere between 18 and 22 or 23 people a week. Uh-huh. I probably carry an active caseload of 100 to 150 people at any one time and max out, you know, and rarely take new people. So what I am starting to focus on doing is I mentor new clinicians. So I teach up at Oregon Health Sciences University, our local university, in both the nurse midwifery and the psychiatric nurse practitioner program. And I do all of their reproductive psychiatry or, mental health content around the reproductive years for women so that we can get clinicians prepared. Right.
Yeah. Because the work that you're doing with your patients is so important.
And thank you.
Yet when you take a look back and you look at the scale of the problem, you've got to be thinking to yourself, yeah, how can I go from, you know, a caseload of 100 patients to, you know, how can a million,
that's
10
right.
million, 100 million women get this treatment that they need?
That's right. So, you know, I teach in the university setting these young and old, but you know, these new clinicians. And so, you know, I get to plant that seed of, you need to be thinking about population specific mental health and how it's different working with women at between adolescence and menopause because of, you know, metabolic differences in their brains and hormonal differences. And also because of what's happening in society, you know, the gender pay gap, sexism, the Me Too phenomenon, those things affect the private lives of women and psychiatric symptoms and disorders. So teaching that content, and then now I'm also doing consulting work with other organizations that want to incorporate healthcare organizations that want to incorporate, female specific specialty mental health care. And then I have now started doing live 1 and 2 day trainings for clinicians and then online web-based on-demand education as well, specifically for nurse midwives who want to increase their skill set. When I'm doing that work, Jeff, I know that every clinician that I'm teaching is then going to go out and touch thousands, maybe tens of thousands of women in their career. And that work really feeds me in a different way than the one-on-one steady work with one person or one family. It's different. It's like, you know, they speak to different parts of me. But that work that I get to do as an educator straddling both of these fields really feeds that activist part of me and helps me feel like I'm making a dent on this enormous, in this enormous national global problem that we're facing.
When you say, it feeds you, what does that mean for you?
I think the most vulnerable way I can say that is I know that if I died tomorrow, it would be okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
How does it feel inside to say that?
It feels sad. I'm not done. But with getting my webinar up, you know, a recording of a 1 day training that I created, knowing that that's been captured, I feel a deep peace that I didn't know before that. I would like to see the 2 day training get captured. That one is for psychiatric clinicians who are generalists and psychotherapists. There are other people doing similar work, but not quite that same level of specificity. Like, for example, Postpartum Support International has a wonderful certificate training program that's a little more general. They do fantastic work, but I would like to capture my 2 day training as well sometime. I don't know if I'll ever do it. But yeah, I feel deep peace knowing that my work has been recorded.
Wow.
And it's available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm really interested in the meaningful life, you know, and how people find that. And I feel like we've gotten a little bit of, you know, a sliver of kind of hearing a little bit of your story and your path, how you got to this way. I guess, is there anything you would add about what exactly it is about having completed that webinar, getting it live, what you're doing that makes you, like, is that connected to for you to the meaningful life or that sense of peace?
Yeah, I think I'm learning through working with other people and just being a human on the planet that we all have a desire to be seen or to be known deeply. And in some ways, sharing that clinician education, that work, is really pulling from something very deep inside of myself in terms of my sense of ethics, my personal belief system, my integrity, my philosophy. It's kind of funny. It took me 6 years to complete my undergrad degree, and then I got a master's degree and a post-master's degree. And I remember when I changed my degree in undergrad from political science, philosophy, and women's studies, I thought, oh, this is so sad. I'm not going to use that. But in this one effort, I'm using everything, both everything I've learned and also personal experiences. And it's kind of like a life thesis. Mm-hmm. And that's deeply meaningful and feels like a unique contribution that is of me, that somebody else couldn't necessarily replicate and do it the way that I would do it. For me, I wonder sometimes if this is how, you know, an author feels when he or she releases a memoir. It feels like my memoir of my my personal and my professional life, although I don't, I have a few comments in the webinar series about my personal life. I mentioned that I have twins. I talk a little bit about the beauty of having grandmothers in our life. But there's not a lot that's overtly personal. And yet what you see is deeply of me, you know, my personality. And there's frankly love in that work.
Yeah.
Of a kind, just like there is in my work, you know, one-on-one with my clients in session.
Yeah.
And that's very meaningful to me.
For people, so one of the things that you just said that I'm catching on to mm-hmm. is this, you know, it's not only that desire to be deeply seen, but mm-hmm. then also to kind of bring together all of these parts that are uniquely you. Mm-hmm. And that's the part that you kind of signify as that deeply seen. Yeah. For other people mm-hmm. who have that same desire, what recommendation would you give to them if they also are looking for that?
I would say that if, you know, somebody out there has an idea, a concept that they want to flesh out and share, the first thing I would say is it requires great discipline. Most of this webinar was created over 8 years between 5 and 7 in the morning. And on scraps of, you know, ripped pieces of paper that were saved and carried around and paper clipped together and then, you know, typed into notes that became PowerPoints that became lectures that were first practiced in front of, you know, nurse practitioner students and then paid audiences and then finally edited heavily, you know, into this series. I would also say it takes having a good self-esteem because you have to ask your loved ones to organize around this passion. You have to take up space and time. You have to ask for accommodation. In my case, that was lots of childcare from my husband who had already given me lots of childcare to go back to school and get another degree and start a business. And I volunteer all my time that I teach is volunteered. I also mentor a number of people today. I have a mentoring lunch after our interview. And so I have a lot of support from my partner and our family and our paid child caregivers, you know, that allow me to do this work, which is also my hobby, you know, essentially. But I care about myself to listen in and to recognize like, no, this feeds me. I need to ask for this space. This is my work in this one life. And I don't really believe that there is more after this. You know, I think I'm probably going to be soil when this is all over. So I feel some burden to do what I need to do in this life. And I also find, interestingly, that if I listen to my deepest calling, I'm more present for everybody else in my life when I'm with them. If I answer this deep need, it sets me free in the rest of my life. And we're not talking about, you know, we're not talking about 20 hours a week. We're talking about 4, 2, 3, 4 focused hours a week when I was in the heat of developing the webinar and all the content over the years. So.
Were there any points where you thought, I should just give this up? And like what was the biggest barrier, I guess, for you, or hurdle you had to overcome in order to get this webinar together?
Yeah. I was never going to give it up. Because I knew that even if I made it and I posted on my website and nobody came and, you know, took my course, that it was still out there. And that was important to me, that I needed to be able to say to all the clinicians, I get calls endlessly all week from obstetric clinicians, nurse midwives, psychiatric nurse practitioners, therapists, looking for information and consultation about the care of their own patients. I needed to have a place to send people because I can't tell people about what I do in a soundbite. I can't do it. It defies that type of sort of, you know, blog type blog post. It's a process. To do it well, there are skills that you have to install, but it can be done. You know, it can be done, and I've captured how to do that. And I needed a place to direct these people to. I still try and help every single person who emails me and calls me with that person who's basically sitting in front of them. But I don't want to teach, you know, I don't want to give people fish. I want to teach them how to fish. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I'm after.
Yeah. I have just a couple other questions. Like, what is working for you right now to combat stress and anxiety in your daily life?
My bike commute is the first thing. My children, I have 2 9-year-olds and they are wild and funny, and exceedingly loving and totally unpredictable. My mother, it's interesting to me all the time that I work with mothers because I was mothered exceedingly well. My mother is still an active part of my life. I see her usually most weeks, at least once, some weeks more than that. She's, along with my sister, probably my 2 closest friends. Nature. Those are the big things that sustain me. My extended family, almost all of my vacations are with extended family. So my dad, my stepmom, you know, aunts, uncles, to my children, cousins, family, friends.
Yeah. And maybe this question might be redundant based mm-hmm. on how you just answered that, mm-hmm. but is there anything that you find has brought you the most happiness? What has brought you the most happiness in the last 24 hours?
Last night after work, I went to my neighbor's house. We have happy hour every week on Thursday or Friday. And I went and spent an hour and a half with a longtime girlfriend and her husband, who's a longtime dear friend of mine. And they love me utterly. I mean, they know, you know, all my foibles and all my personality quirks, of which there are lots. And we laughed and had fun and talked about a lot of things that are really hard. And it was really beautiful. It was perfect. Yeah, it filled me up.
Last thing is there anything that you would want to share with people who are pursuing a meaningful path?
I would say this, that the challenge is challenge, and difficulty and even suffering are inherent in the cultivation of meaning, and that we need not be afraid of those things, that we have evolved as a species to weather all of those things beautifully. We have very flexible brains. Our capacity to learn new skills and adapt continues until the day we die, even if we live to be over 100. I would also say there's never been more help for the cultivation of meaning and new skills, and you only have to tap into that if you're fortunate enough to be able to do that.
Oh, beautifully said.
Thank you, Jeff.
I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Adria. As the podcast host, I've now listened to this show multiple times, and I've always gotten something new out of it with each listen. If you're interested in learning more about Adria, you can find her at lifecyclehealthandeducation.com. You can also come to the website for this show, ignitedwithmeaning.com, where I've got the link to Adria's site, as well as a couple of select resources Adria provided so that women and their families who may be experiencing some of the challenges we talked about in the show have something to turn to. Also, ever since our interview, I've been thinking more about this question of the role that suffering has in a meaningful life. It was really insightful to hear Adria's answer, and I've also found and read a book that dissects this issue of the role that suffering plays in a meaningful life in great detail. So I've written a blog post about it that you can go and read through, and I'll plan to share some of those insights in an upcoming show as well. Lastly, I want to share what's coming up next. I'm really excited to be speaking with Simon Goland. Simon has been spending the last 2 decades thinking about the meaning of life. But not just thinking about it, he has developed a workshop that he calls Right Livelihood Quest, where he works with people to help them uncover their unique life purpose. Simon has his PhD in eco-psychology, which he will be able to explain much better than I, but brings in the natural environment to help inform life purpose. So I can't wait to ask him more about that. Thank you for listening to this episode of Ignited with Meaning, where we're exploring the terrain of a meaningful life, creating a roadmap for that, and generating more happiness along the way. I hope you're walking away with some ideas and inspiration for living a meaningful life for yourself. If you did, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you go to listen to your favorite shows. Until next time, be persistent, keep looking, and together we'll build the meaningful lives we want.